This is the Observations Podcast for Sunday, the 29th of January, 2024. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm Dale Franks.
I'm Michael Wade.
And it's been a very interesting week. A lot of stuff has been happening that I want to talk about, but I think our overarching topic of the day has to be institutional failure and how widespread institutional failure has become. And I want to start off...
Well, and just to be fair, Dale, this is a running theme that we've had now for certainly all of this year, and going back at least, I'd say, till October, September last year. So this is not necessarily a new topic, but it's becoming more prescient, more immediate, I think, is the issue.
Yeah, I think the problem is the number of incidences of institutional failure that you can point out have grown so exponentially. And some of the things that we're going to talk about today imply a significant amount of danger for the future of the Republic.
Yes.
But let's start off with something simple and a little more amusing. Let's ease our way into this whole discussion. Today, yesterday, or day before yesterday, when was it? January 25th. So,
right,
a couple of days ago now, Senator Amy Klobuchar posted this on X with a picture of the president. And of course, you know, blue collar Joe hanging out with union workers. And, you know, first of all, I'm always amused that a guy who has spent the last 50 years in Washington, D.C., a couple of terms as a congressman, long time as a senator, then vice president, now as president, I'm amused that he tries to push himself off as this sort of blue collar fella. And it's even more amusing whenever pictures like this are posted. Let's take a closer look at this picture. So let's just open it up in a new tab. And in fact, let's just open the image in an entirely new tab. And while we're here, let's zoom in a little bit. Let's zoom in on Joe wearing his hard hat. Now, look, it's been about, oh, I don't know, it's probably been close to 40 years since I've had to wear a hard hat on a job site. And even I know that the nap strap is called the nap strap because it goes on the nape of your neck, not on your forehead.
Right. And matter of fact, back when you were wearing them, they didn't have that little nice little doohickey where you can twist it.
Yeah, actually, that's true. That adjustment knob wasn't there. I think as I remember the nap strap that we had were those little plastic nubs that you had to like rip apart and then redo and snap them back together. Then you put it on.
Like the back of baseball caps or whatever, but on two sides.
Yeah, and then it wouldn't fit, and you'd have to take it off and because the whole point of the nap strap is to fit under the back of your skull where it curves, right?
So it actually keeps the hat on your head.
Yeah, so if something falls and bonks you on the head, it doesn't knock your hard hat off. That's just part of the suspension system on a hard hat. Now, on the new hard hats, they have that cool little knob, right, where you can just reach back and you can tighten.
Which I like. They've since instituted it in like sneakers and golf shoes and other sportswear.
Yeah, the technology increases and it makes the wear of hard hats a little more, and the adjustment way more convenient. However, if you're going to pretend to be a blue collar fella, you should at least learn how to put a hard hat on correctly with the strap in the back. Good old blue collar Joe doesn't know enough about hard hats to know how they fit. Now, sometimes, and this appears to be a case where the bill is on the front and this guy has reversed the suspension in the hat so that the bill is in the back. Not uncommon, especially for guys who are welders, right? Because they need to be able to remove the bill. And they, you put your welding mask on so you can raise it and lower it without the bill being in the way. Although, in most cases, welders don't have to reverse the suspension on their hard hats. There are welding hard hats. So why this guy has it reversed, I don't know. It doesn't matter. The strap goes on the back of your neck. Anybody who's been on a job site should technically know that.
However, including the two people he's sitting there, or three people he's sitting there
with. Yeah, at least three people know that he's wearing that hat wrong. But immediately people on Twitter started to talk about how amusing it was that Joe Biden was wearing the hard hat backwards. And to his rescue came Snopes, who said, no, he is not wearing that hat backwards. This is just more right-wing bullshit, you know, making fun of Joe Biden. That lasted for about 7 hours. And Snopes had to go.
This was sort of unprecedented, too, with Snopes, that they got so much feedback, they actually changed their rating.
Yes, this was the initial rating that Snopes gave. Obviously, this is just absolutely false. And it took about 8 hours to completely reverse that and to go to that claim. And, of course, if you go to Snopes now, it does say it's true. But they do have an editor's note about, you know, here's why we thought that he was wearing the hard. Here's why we rated it as false. But people were saying different. So we had to change our rating. But as funny as this is, and this is the funniest how it started and how's it going that I've watched happen in real time in a long time. How did they get this wrong in the first place? I mean, they're a fact checker. They're supposed to be this objective arbiter of unbiased and objective facts. But of course,
well, we know that's not what they are.
Yeah, but what it does tell me is that the guy who wrote this article, and you can see people are just going off on Joe Biden wearing it backwards. They even in their original article had the guy wearing what appears to be the same guy wearing the same hard hat. And of course the bill is in the back, but so's the Napster.
The strap.
And they're saying, so even though we have a picture of this guy wearing the hat like this, we're still going to rate it false. What it tells me is that the person who wrote this story, and David Emery, a West Coast-based writer and editor with 25 years of fact-checking rumors, hoaxes, and contemporary legends. I don't see anything there about fact-checking, anything about construction or manual labor equipment, which is why he got it wrong. He's been a writer for 25 years. It's probably, and I'm sure he's younger than I am, and he has probably not been on a job site for longer than I have. So he doesn't know, but he felt perfectly happy and perfectly competent at writing a fact check about this. And this is all amusing. It's all kind of funny. And whenever a fact checker fails to, you know, the president is wearing a silly hat, true or false. Okay, that's not a big deal. We don't really care.
Oh, no, that's a big deal. I came up with the silly hat rule back in 2000, I guess it was 2004, when John Kerry came out of that.
Yeah, well, okay,
I don't even know what it was.
There was a general
with a rabbit hat on.
Yeah, there's a it was John Kerry who was wearing a clean suit, right? So it had like a hood that came around his face, and he was crawling.
That
through.
Was like the first post that I put up that went like big time viral. It got picked up by Andrew Sullivan. It got picked up by Instapundit, and then
yeah, he was
a whole bunch of people.
He was crawling through some kind of duct or something. In fact, I don't even know if I can find that John Kerry
silly hat
suit. I don't know if silly hat would work, but John Kerry clean suit does work. We can actually open that image. It's pretty small, but we can certainly share it thanks to the amazing technology that we currently have. And I can actually make this a little bigger.
Is this okay, Mr. Wonka?
Exactly. Rule number one of politics, don't wear the silly hat. If someone gives you a silly hat, tell them you do not wish to wear the silly hat, and you certainly wish to have anyone take a picture of you in the silly hat. Same thing kind of holds true.
As a matter of fact, when Fred Thompson ran, Remember, it was a kind of, and this is a little bit obscure, and maybe only political junkies remember this, but when Fred Thompson was running for the GOP nomination for president, I guess that was 2008. He was at a, I don't know, a firehouse or something in like Tennessee, which is where he was from. And they offered him, you know, a hat. And he was like, I'm good. Thanks.
Yeah, I'm good. he knows the rule.
They tried to give him shit about it, but it was like, hey, look, silly hat rule. Everybody knows it.
Yeah, not happening. I'm not going to wear your silly hat suit. But, you know, we can laugh at Snopes, and we can talk about how Snopes can't be trusted. And I guess it's fine, but it is emblematic. It's symptomatic of a bigger problem, because if we can't trust fact checkers to talk about silly hats correctly, then how in the world can we trust them to talk about complex issues that may be issues of controversy? Let's go back to 2020 and the origin of COVID, and whether or not COVID came from a lab leak at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, or whether it was natural. Well, anybody back in 2020, thanks to Ralph Baric, who, by the way, had a vested interest in ensuring that nobody thought it came from Wuhan, Ralph Baric wrote a letter in Nature, got several co-signers on. We now know that even the co-signers realized that it could be a result of a lab leak, but they all signed on anyway. And all the fact checkers back then basically called, you know, it's a baseless claim that coronavirus was engineered. It could not. These are the fact checkers. Here's another one. Now, at least in this one, which is from the Poynter Institute at PolitiFact, they had to add a note a year later. I'm sorry, it wasn't Ralph Baric. It was Peter Daszak that was pushing the natural origins. Ralph Baric at North Carolina, who has probably the number two virology lab in the world that he runs, finally wrote a paper in Science the next year that said, hey, lab leak is quite possibly the origin of COVID, and we can't keep telling people that it's a bunch of bullshit. That completely changed the argument. It took a year for that argument to change. Now, at least after that article or that open letter in Science by Ralph Baric, at least PolitiFact had the grace to say, okay, we were wrong. This may be a controversy. It is no longer a debunked conspiracy theory, apparently. It may actually be possible. This is a case of the fact checkers screwing up something that was of actual public importance. And they were perfectly happy to go along and collaborate with Peter Daszak and Echo Health, trying to push anybody away from any insistence that COVID might have come from the lab. And of course, since then, we've gotten all these emails from people who are participating in Peter Daszak's thing, who were saying amongst each other, well, you know, this probably did come from China, but we can't really say anything because it'll really piss the Chinese off and they'll get angry.
Well, and that was the impetus the entire time. But, and the fact that we have since learned, and we kind of had an inkling at the time, that we paid for it. Our tax money went to pay for that research at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, thanks to grants from Tony Fauci.
Yeah.
And NIH. His good buddy.
Yeah. We know the research and we know it was gain of function research.
Mm-hmm.
So Peter Daszak didn't want anybody to look. And by the way, this research was banned.
That's right. By Obama, of all people.
The Obama administration put out a hard black letter rule that you could not do gain of function research because the dangers of any sort of lab leak were far outweighed the benefits you could receive from it. Yet, despite that ban on all federal funding for this, somehow Tony Fauci managed to funnel money to Peter Daszak and Echo Health, who were doing gain-of-function research at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Was it on COVID?
And not just there. There's another one in Wuhan, too, that they were also funding, as well as ones in Ukraine and other places. It wasn't just the WIV. There were a lot of places that were, well, hopefully not still, but we don't know. We don't get any transparency that way.
Right. I mean, Tony Fauci lied to Congress about this
over and over again. I mean, Rand Paul had his number down straight, and Fauci lied and lied and got indignant and, fought it. But eventually the truth came out. Rand Paul's exactly right. He is a doctor. He kind of had some inkling about what he was talking about. And Fauci just couldn't fool him.
No, but he tried.
And he did fool a lot of people.
And by the way, anybody ever prosecute Fauci for lying under oath to Congress?
No, never.
Will anyone ever prosecute him for lying under oath to Congress?
Yeah, we know that. It's just never going to happen.
And yet,
Peter Navarro, Steve Bannon, the two I know of who are being held in contempt of court for not replying to a subpoena from a fake congressional committee.
Yeah. This past week, Peter Navarro got sentenced to 4 months.
Funny. It's absolutely a two-tier system, and it's just so starkly obvious at this point. Yeah. And I guess, knowing where we're going, that's, I think, the real issue. It's just, it's become so starkly obvious that you just can't deny it anymore. There is a two-tier system. There are people in government who get away with things that we cannot. Government treats itself before it treats us. There's literally no denying that. And it's such a cancer. It is spread through every institution, not only in the federal government, but in every other institution it touches, including state agencies, state governments, not to mention all the NGOs and other participants at the trough of our federal dollars. There's far too much evidence that's even been admitted to brush this away as, there's some bad actors. No. This is systematic.
Yeah. I mean, we start off with fact checking, but these fact checkers are all like independent media organizations. And in real terms, the idea of an objective, unbiased media really only existed in this country for about 35 years, right? From about 1945 to 1975. Maybe 1980. And then we began to return to what is the traditional American media, right? Which is completely partisan.
Right.
And completely biased. I mean, many of the newspapers that were founded in the 18th and 19th century had Democrat or Republican in their name.
That's exactly right.
There was very little doubt what their
or populist or, whatever. Right.
And so we've kind of reverted to that mean. We had this golden age of Edward R. Murrow objective journalism that lasted for like 35 years, and now we're back to what it was. But that's okay, and it was okay in the 18th and 1900s, and for most of the 20th century, because we had a government that was more or less, sometimes much less, committed to the idea of a general applicability of the rule of law, a sense of the limits of government's competence, and a sense of the constitutional limits that were imposed on the government.
I think that's right. And it was observed by both sides, of the chambers. And it was, there was a certain amount of comedy and camaraderie that, hey, look, we're going to argue to the death and get as nasty as possible about these things up to this point. But then there's beyond that. And, you know, that's where we got to come together. And we did up through the 80s. Late 80s, certainly George W. Bush's term and into Clinton, it just started getting much more divided.
We used to have a saying, politics stops at the water's edge.
Right, yeah. And that just sort of died all of a sudden, late 80s, 90s. Don't know why. Doesn't matter why. It's just the truth.
But you can survive having a sort of a crappy press when you have strong governmental institutions. But what happens when they start to go? And let's talk about immigration, right? So in general, federal law trumps state law when it comes to immigration. Basically, we have the Supremacy Clause. Once the federal government decides this is my deal, not your deal, to the states, if the Constitution is silent, the states can do what they want. If it's part of the constitutional powers granted to Congress, Congress can stay silent and states can pretty much do what they want. Once Congress says, no, 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 this is our deal, it becomes Congress's deal. And look, that's fine when everybody is playing on the same page that, okay, the feds are going to take this over, but we can trust the feds to, as the presidential oath says, take care that the laws be faithfully executed. So if you can trust the feds, then the Supremacy Clause is just fine. Again, everybody at the state and federal level being on the same page can play that game. What happens when the feds decide that they're not going to obey the law anymore? Then what do you do? And we are seeing that right now in Texas. Because Texas has decided they are not having this, you know, 10, 15, 20,000 people coming in a day in places like Eagle Pass, where there are only 27,000 residents. They simply can't do it. So, of course, the state puts up barbed wire. The feds come in, pulls down the barbed wire, which, by the way, this last week, the Supreme Court said they can do. So Texas said, all right, well, you didn't
say. They lifted the injunction on the feds. The injunction stopped the feds from cutting the concertina wire. The Supreme Court lifted that injunction. That's all it did.
Yeah, but what they didn't say was Texas can't put up any more barbed wire. So
right, they put no onus on Texas whatsoever.
Yeah, so it was just that, okay, well, if the feds come in and move it, they can move it. Okay, fine. But Texas decided this week that they were going to send the National Guard down to do more border security stuff. At this point, something like 24, 25 states now have joined Texas.
I think it's Texas plus 25.
Yeah, and many of those states have said, you know what, we're going to deploy our National Guard to Texas to assist them with closing off the border to Mexico.
Which about 10 of them had already done prior to this showdown. But yeah, now there's been an open call to resist the federal abandonment of its duties. And the states are taking over and they're pressing the issue.
Even though technically the Supremacy Clause means that the feds should control that, not the states. But again, what do you do when the feds won't?
Okay, so that's a really good point. The Supremacy Clause does not obviate any action by states. It just means that you can't, typically you can't do less than the restriction, but you could do more. As a state, you could do more. As a state, you can't undermine the minimum of what the federal law says, but you can raise the maximum. And we've seen this has been the law now for about 40 some years. I think this was decided back in the 70s. And that's clear cut constitutional law. There's also constitutional actually provisions that guarantee to the states defense of invasion. It's hard to argue that this is anything less than an invasion.
Well,
one that the federal governments are, that the federal government is actually facilitating and encouraging.
That is an iffy argument based on some precedent that goes, and there's not much, but certainly some of the precedent that goes back to the 18th century indicates otherwise. And I forget the exact case, but there, it's complex, but basically the idea has always been, nope, we consider invasion a military action. Immigration is not a military action, so it doesn't count as invasion. Certain Texas is going to make that argument. I suspect the Supreme Court is not going to buy the argument that immigration is an invasion. They may buy the argument that the feds aren't doing what they're supposed to.
It's already in violation of federal law. What's going on? Federal government is just not enforcing it.
Yeah. They're having the budget deal. And what Joe Biden wants is money for Ukraine. And the Republicans are saying, no, you get no money for Ukraine unless you close the border. And so Biden is saying, okay, well, I could shut down the border if only you'd give me the authority to do so. I would. It'll also give me as president the emergency authority to shut down the border until it could get back under control. If that bill were law today, I'd shut the border right now and do it quickly. The problem with this argument from Joe Biden is that it's a lie. And it's a lie because 19 U.S.C. 1318 exists and has existed. It's part of the Tariff Act of, 1930, where basically it says if the president declares there's an emergency on the border, they can shut down every single port of entry until the emergency is done. If you want to go and look it up, the U.S. House has it there. It is 19 U.S.C. 1318. It's already there. And by the way, we can deport anybody we want, anytime we want, who enter the country illegally, because 8 U.S.C. 1227 is also a thing. And you can export anybody who is inadmissible at the time of entry, which is to say anyone who enters the United States at any place other than a designated port of entry, and their entry then violates their status, or if their status has been adjusted, whatever. That's a catch-all. That's everybody who enters the United States illegally. They are inadmissible at the time of entry simply because they're entering illegally, not at a designated port of entry. We don't need to give these people a trial. We don't need to do anything other than stick them on a bus and send them back to Mexico. The president already has that authority. What he's not doing is using it.
That's exactly right.
And by the way,
that's the whole complaint.
We've done this before. We shut down the border completely after 9/11, and I think we kept it shut for like 4 or 5 days. And I mean, that was a total shutdown of the border.
Yeah. So, it's the authority has been there for quite some time. And actually, one could argue that the constitutional authority, without government, without congressional action, was already there for the president. But
we don't even need to go there.
If you're not going to actually enforce those laws, well, obviously that's what impeachment's there for. But there are other actions that states can take to protect themselves. They didn't give up all their power. States don't get to make individual naturalization rules or immigration rules. But there's actually not much when it comes to constitutional law that prevents states from enforcing what's already on the books without the federal government being involved.
Yeah, Texas a couple of weeks ago just made a new law to enforce basically the U.S. immigration law, right. saying that, yeah, we'll just deport you for crime to enter the state illegally. And, right. of course, they're going to have to go to court, and they're going to have to defend that as well. Everything that Texas has been doing, and it's largely been Texas in this, everything that they've been doing to try to secure the border, the Biden administration has threatened to or has actually taken them to court to sue them to stop it.
Now, Obama did the same thing, and that's where the most recent precedent comes from, when he sued Arizona for doing some similar things. And the Supreme Court sided with the Obama administration. That's a problem, because the states shouldn't be left at the mercy of, you know, the vicissitudes of what the federal government decides it wants to do that day. That's a reneging of the guarantee promised to the states by the federal government in the Constitution. You know, I know our listeners, watchers, whatever, are pretty clear on this, but just to put it out there out loud, the entire point of the Constitution, the whole reason we're called the United States of America, is that the states are sovereign beings. They're sovereign entities. They gave up some of that power that they have as sovereign states to an organized federal government to oversee everything, but only certain powers. It's a government of limited powers, and only those that were ceded by the states and granted to the federal government in the Constitution. The states didn't give up everything. They certainly didn't give up the ability to enforce their laws or to protect their borders. I don't see any evidence anywhere ever that that was the case. However, it is true that the U.S. Constitution reigns supreme, but it reigns supreme over the federal government as well. And if the federal government isn't holding up its part of the bargain, that makes the compact kind of null and void, honestly. It's literally a breach of contract.
Yes, but of course, the problem is the federal government is going to say, naturally, hey, we're not violating the terms of the compact. In fact, we get to set the terms of the compact. You know, something else we've talked about a lot, but it now seems to have an outsized importance, and we can now see the effect of doing it, which is the 17th Amendment.
Yes.
Once we said we're going to directly elect U.S. senators, we're not going to let the state legislatures choose them, we just essentially removed the voice of states from the federal government. We turned the Senate.
That's exactly right.
We turned the Senate into a slightly more exclusive House of Representatives. And of course, the way that you buy votes from the voters is way different than the way that you buy votes from the state legislature.
Mm-hmm.
And the state legislature can always just put somebody else in your job if they don't like the way that you're doing it. So the states lost their voice. And what we ended up creating was a system in which the states largely get treated like administrative subdivisions of the federal government.
Arrondissements of the national government. Yep.
And so now we have this situation in Texas, which quite frankly, I think is should be far more frightening to people than they realize. Because we are edging toward a state doing something that no state has tried to do since the 1940s and 1950s, nullification. They're saying we don't care what the federal government says, and we don't care what the Supreme Court says in support of the federal government, because we think those decisions are wrong. We think the federal government is failing to fulfill its responsibilities. And you can't just let the Supreme Court bail you out and say, yeah, you don't have to do any of this stuff you don't want to do. We're getting close to a formal constitutional crisis that, as far as I can tell, very few people can see coming. And when you have 25 or 26 states now who are saying, yes, we are going to intervene along with Texas in enforcing immigration law the way we think it needs to be enforced because the federal government isn't doing it, you're setting up, and I hate to say another Fort Sumter, but I think we're getting closer than most of us are going to find comfortable.
I absolutely agree. And, you know, you and I were conversing about this during the week, but I absolutely agree with you. I think that the crux of the matter is going to be this issue. I think the feds have staked a claim that they can't back up. And if they do back it up, I'm afraid of what comes next. This is a powerful movement of half to more than half of the states that make up the union, pushing back on federal government complacency. And either you're going to do your job, federal government, or we're going to do it for you. And then we're going to come after you legally. I don't have a problem with that. What I have a worry about is that the states feel forced into this position, and rightly so, I think. And B, what is the response that the federal government is going to do? What's the most likely thing that a Joe Biden administration, that's really being run by Obama in the background.
Hold on.
Well, what are they going
to
do?
Hold on. The first question we have to ask is, what is the dumbest thing they could do?
Okay. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
And fair. That, I think, has to be our default answer, barring some other evidence that might change that opinion.
That's a fair point.
What happens if the Border Patrol shows up at some place like Eagle Pass? That's just the one that everybody knows. I mean, there's 3,000 miles of border. It could be anywhere. What happens if the Border Patrol shows up and says, yeah, we're tearing this down? And the National Guard says, no, we don't think you're going to do that today. And the Border Patrol says, yes, we are. And what we have is a bunch of armed men who are in irreconcilable positions.
Military trained men.
Out in the middle of the desert, deciding on the spot how this is going to play out.
Mm-hmm. Well, thankfully, well, not so much for the feds, but the CBP officers and people on the ground there, I said, we have no plans. We're backing the Texas National Guard. We're backing what's it called in Texas? The Texas military something. And anybody else from Texas on state officials from Texas who are looking to secure that border. CBP is now 100% behind them. At least the actual people on the ground. And they've made it quite clear that they are not interested in challenging Texas or any of the state authorities. They see their job as completely aligned with what Texas is trying to do.
Yeah. By the way, I came up with my own version of the Goliad flag earlier this week. Come and take it. Showing the razor wire. Yeah, this is. We are heading towards a collision between at least some of the states and the federal government. Now, one should point out that many states are perfectly happy with the federal government doing this. They're happy to be subservient to the federal government for whatever reason that might be. But 25 of the states, of course, they're the 25 states where, many fewer people live. So,
New York, California, they seem to be fine with what the feds are doing.
Yeah, they're perfectly happy working with the feds, but other states are not, and I fear that we are headed for a bigger problem. To the extent, and we talked about this earlier. We talked about how Fauci, he's never going to get prosecuted for literally lying to Congress. We have the receipts. We know the grant that he provided Dr. Fauci to Peter Daszak and Echo Health Alliance in contravention of the Obama administration ban on gain-of-function research. We have it. We publicly released, or Rand Paul publicly released the grant documents and the grant approvals from Fauci. We know they exist. He doesn't get prosecuted for lying to Congress or for contempt of Congress. But Peter Navarro, who decides he's not going to show up to the January 6th committee, which largely was a committee constructed in defiance of congressional rules for committee formation.
It didn't follow any of the House rules.
Yeah, so they didn't show up for what they considered a
non-subpoena, because it's they didn't have subpoena power.
Yeah, and yet there be, so you know, we go back to that two-tier justice system where we know who's going to go to jail and we know who's going to walk away scot-free. And we've been talking about this ever since, you know, the Hillary Clinton, the email thing. The fact that she was running her own email server was a violation of federal law. Forget whether there was any classified information on it. Maybe there wasn't a single bit. We know that that's not true, but maybe it still wouldn't matter. It was still illegal to run her own server outside of the government.
Yep. But
federal law and the National Records Act and a couple of others requires that the federal government have full control over all of these servers.
Which she knew.
Yeah, of course she knew. She just didn't want to comply, and she knew that she wouldn't have to.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turns out,
and that's the biggest problem.
And so we have, right? Yeah,
these people know they're beyond the law.
And
I mean, look at Eric Holder. Eric Holder is a great example because he was held in contempt of Congress for refusing to pony up the, what was it? It was the ones about the guns, right? Where they were selling guns to like cartel people.
Yeah, Operation Fast and Furious. They were
Fast and Furious.
They were actually getting American gun dealers to violate federal gun laws to perform straw purchases at the behest of the FBI. And also the BATF. And they sent, and we don't really even know how many fully automatic weapons that they sent to Mexico that ended up in the hands of cartels.
We know of at least one.
Yeah, we know of at least one.
The one that killed Brian Terry.
Yeah, we know of at least one because Brian Terry was killed by one of them, federal agent.
And Holder never answered for that. He defied Congress. It was sent to the appropriate authorities in D.C. to prosecute him. Like, yeah, no, we're not going to do that because he's a Democrat. It was a Democrat administration. Yeah. We're not going to do anything about that. But, never held accountable.
But if the federal government isn't going to obey the law, or even worse, what happens when the federal government or its employees just decide that they're just going to disobey the law?
Well, they are disobeying. What are you talking about when they decide? No. They've been doing this forever.
Yeah, well, this week, independent journalist, and I don't know much about her, and I don't think I have to, but this lady named Millie Weaver somehow came across this series of Zoom meetings that were attended by federal government employees, state government employees, at least one military officer, employees of non-governmental organizations. And this was all way back during the 2020 election. And basically, they were there to figure out how to ensure that Donald Trump didn't get re-elected. So right before the 2020 election, they had a Feds for Democracy meeting that took place. And it's, and you can follow this post on X and you can go through. She has extensive excerpts of what was said at this meeting. So you can actually watch portions of this. She was able to identify several of the people who were there and the agencies for which they work. So we have people from like see DHS, the U.S. Department of Labor, USAID, Department of Energy. There's some
State Department people in there.
Yeah, so we have all of these people. And by the way, this is all blatantly illegal. And they knew it
it's
was...
It's all violently, or violently. It's all blatantly in opposition to the Hatch Act. It's also a violation of very contract that they sign when they become a civil servant. Remember, these people were working for the Trump administration at the time, and they were actively seeking to undermine that administration, not just seeking, but also doing the undermining.
And by the
way, blatantly illegal.
By the way,
I would say seditious.
By the way, they knew it was wrong. What's learned in the room can leave with you, but what's said in the room stays in the room. Participants are advised to take those discussions offline if they want to talk about quote unquote high risk actions they want to take. This is a conspiracy. This was done in secret, and it was done in knowing contravention of what federal employees are allowed to do when it comes to party politics. And by the way, this goes on forever, forever. There will likely be disagreements about which ballots should be thrown away and for what reason. And of course, it's never a coup when we do it.
Right.
It's only a coup when Donald Trump does it. When we do it, we're just defending democracy. Donald Trump is the bad guy. We're the angels. And if that means that we have to subvert the government by subverting or changing the meaning of federal rules, well, we can go ahead and do that. We can slow roll things. We can add different interpretations onto the rules, because after all, we're the ones who get to interpret the rules. There are 20-some slides of this stuff, and many of them you can actually watch while all of these people are talking about how they are going to
That one in particular subvert, is very interesting.
Subvert the pillars of support in the United States government.
Yeah, this is, I mean, it's almost right out of Marxist action programs. I mean, it might even be from all I know. With that stuff about the pillars, I remember reading that kind of stuff from agitprop in Germany, from the communists and the socialists in France. And this is back in the 1930s and 40s. This is old school stuff of a skullduggery type. The insiders are taking over the asylum.
Yes, and by the way, they have to be sure that they call President Trump's plan to contest the election. That's the coup.
Right. Huh.
So it becomes a coup.
How'd that work out?
It becomes a coup just to contest the election. Now, you know, whether they did any of these things, we don't know. But the fact is, Millie Weaver found all of these documents. She found the recordings of the original Zoom meetings. She presents them all in this very, very long Twitter thread that, or X thread that you can go look up. You have federal employees violating the law directly to determine who wins an election, or at least to determine whether who loses the elections. This is, I mean, there's no other way to put it. You want to talk about January 6th as an insurrection? Fine. Then this is a black letter seditious conspiracy.
No question in my mind about that. And, you know, we started this off talking about the rot of institutions. Well, that's the rot right there. That is the termite infested black lung, whatever else you can come up with, of institutional rot. These people are deep, deep in the institutions. And they're absolutely right. They do have a great deal of power, and they can use it however they want. We saw this already with Lois Lerner, the IRS, and what they were doing. That was the tip, the tiny little tip of the iceberg. This kind of bureaucracy really turns us into an oligarchy. I mean, these are not elected people. They have protections built into the law for their jobs as civil servants. They are the most insulated people in the government. Yes, that's right. And it's up to them how the law gets implemented and actually carried out. And if they don't feel like carrying it out the way that it's supposed to, how do you stop them? You're going to sue the agency? Yeah, good luck. Because guess where that goes? You don't just take that to federal court. You have to go through the agency process first, which is also filled with people who used to do these exact jobs. Talk about industry capture.
Yes, the old administrative law judges who are always so impartial.
Well, and the thing that people don't realize about, they're not Article 3 judges. They're Article 1 judges, or Article 2 judges, I guess, because they're part of the executive agency, right? So they, each ALJ is his or her own jurisdiction. So the Court of Federal Claims, literally right across the street from the White House, that's basically the highest circuit court for government claims against the government, claims under government contracting and whatever else. That is the highest court next to the Supreme Court. Each single judge, and I think there are 15 of them, they are not required to follow the precedent of any of the other judges. There's nothing that binds them except what they may have said before. And even then, it's not conclusive because they can overturn themselves just like that
and
on a case-by-case
basis. Let's talk about how they become judges.
Yeah, that's right. That's a good point, because what they do is they come up through these systems. They come up through the Bureau of Land Management, or they come up through the State Department, or they come up through all these agencies, and then they reach a certain level of expertise. If they have a law background, well, you're ripe to become administrative law judge. Thank you, an ALJ. And then if you become an ALJ, well, then you can go higher. Sometimes they go into the administration again, but a fair amount of them end up becoming judges on the Fed circuit eventually.
But those judges are nominated by the president and
right.
have to be
they have
confirmed
no, and they
by
don't
the
have
Senate.
To be confirmed by the Congress.
But yeah. The ALJ judges don't have congressional. If they actually go into the federal judiciary, obviously they become Article 3 judges, and that.
The federal circuit is still an Article 2. It is not. It is not part of Article 3.
Okay.
Congress did not create.
Okay, I thought you were talking about one of the districts, the federal judicial districts.
Yes.
Okay, fine.
Those are different.
So you're still talking about the administrative courts, but congressional approval for any of them. They just get appointed. And by the way, even if you do manage to make it through those guys, or you come up with some constitutional question that would have to be answered in a real federal court, well, then you got to deal with Chevron deference.
That's right.
Because the Supreme Court has said, well, the agency defines it as X, then I guess we just have to believe whatever the agency says.
So much better when experts make these decisions than the people in Congress.
Yeah. And by the way, you talk about the problem. The problem is the one phrase that goes into practically every federal law that's been written for the last 50 years. The secretary shall have the appropriate power, blah, blah, blah. And they basically
and
just
there have been some,
regulations
of fact,
to the Fed. To
most
the,
famously, exactly. Neil Gorsuch it has called that into question. He's been one of the most challenging federal judges, and now Supreme Court judge, about Chevron deference and whether or not that was fully workable or constitutional. And there is a separation of powers argument that that is Congress handing off legislative power to the executive branch, and that's not okay. That violates the Constitution.
Yeah, it certainly violates separation of powers.
Right.
But they've done it routinely. We have this system that only operates if everybody believes that everybody's playing above board.
Right.
It's increasingly clear that not everybody is playing above board. And I don't know. Well, I do know what we have remedies for it, right? First, we could just impeach. Yeah, we could impeach Joe Biden. We could get rid of him. It's not going to happen, but we could do it.
Right.
We could have the states call a constitutional convention. God knows what would come out of that. But I mean, it could happen. It's not gonna, because we're never going to get 3/4 of the states to agree on anything in terms of a constitutional convention. So, you know, I don't know where we go from here, but I also don't know how this system creaks along the way that it keeps creaking along. And, you know, if you want to take it back to how the political effects that it's having, even outside of this disagreement, which I think may be an extraordinarily dangerous disagreement between the states and the feds on the subject of immigration, people realize, and increasingly realize, that the political parties are not constructed to do what's best for the average voter. They are constructed to keep people in power and to keep whatever money spigot it is, whether it's in Congress, insider trading. I think Nancy Pelosi, what was it, 2 weeks ago, ended up making $700,000 off of NVIDIA. She is one hell of a stock trader. That's all I have to say.
Man, I just, whatever she does, that's what I'm doing.
Yeah, if only I could get access to Nancy's trades, I could probably be pretty well off a decade down the road. Retirement, I think, would no longer be a problematic
big
question
deal,
in
right?
my mind. Yeah.
Well, just go get elected to Congress. What are you talking about?
Well, that does seem to be it. I mean, we can look, and here's the problem. We can look at this stuff, and we often run into stuff that makes us go, right? Like Harry Reid, who literally never worked a private sector job in his life. He was either some sort of county commissioner in bumfuck Nevada, or was in the state
Searchlight.
Yeah, Searchlight, which is the same thing. Then got into Congress, then became a senator, and ends up one of the richest people in Congress.
Through his wealthy land holdings.
Yeah, through his...
He had a knack for picking out those properties.
That's a fella who knew real estate, huh? And we notice that, and we go, that's
until
weird.
He got beat up by his band or what?
Yes, until his exercise machine went wrong. And by the way, he got out of the Senate pretty quick after that exercise machine accident, didn't he?
Yeah.
But we see this and it makes us go,
Uh-huh.
But we see it so often that I think, you know, one of the problems, I was going to write about this week, and I kind of just ran into a brick wall. I can't write 100,000 words on all the things that are going wrong, on all the way that our institutions are failing. We have all of these institutions that work on a day-to-day basis, which is to say that people show up for work there and they go into an office and they do the thing that they do in the office and they go home and every 2 weeks they collect a paycheck. And yet these institutions are utterly incapable of doing the one thing that they're designed to do. For example, let's talk about regulatory capture. If you go back to like when you and I were kids, right? What were the required immunizations that you and I had to have, right?
Right. Measles, you had your
whooping
measles,
cough,
mumps, rubella.
Mumps, rubella, and diphtheria.
And diphtheria, yeah.
There was also, when I was a kid, smallpox. So we had that one.
Yeah, I was just on the other side of that.
So you may not have had that.
So I don't have the mark on my arm.
So I still do. Basically, there were seven. Now, from neonatal to the time you go into school, there is something like 48 or 50 different immunizations that you have to take. Now, people my age didn't just die like flies. So those seven immunizations seem to have worked for us. What's the point of these other immunizations? It could be because there are so many more diseases now and we need all these immunizations to keep us healthier. But it could,
not really.
But it could also be that rather than regulating the pharmaceutical industry, regulatory capture means that the NIH and others are now helping industry. And what better way to help industry than to give them a guaranteed income by making one of their immunizations required for children? And look, if you think...
Yeah, what was it? Moderna? Was it Moderna that was like a nothing company almost?
Yeah, until COVID.
Until
COVID, Moderna had never released.
And now it's one of the biggest pharmaceutical companies in the world.
Yeah.
Although it's starting to fail because...
Yeah, because they have nothing other than the COVID vaccine. That's the only thing they've ever had. So, you know, make your money while you can, I guess. But this revolving door that we see, and by the way, it's not just NIH. Look at the Department of Treasury and Goldman Sachs.
Oh, yeah. SEC and Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, it's funny how I can go from the Securities and Exchange Commission, which is supposed to regulate people with seats on the stock exchange and publicly held companies. And then I can go work at Goldman Sachs for 10 years until my party again takes over the White House. And all of a sudden I'm magically out of Goldman Sachs and back into the Department of Treasury or the SEC, regulating the company that I expect to return to whenever my president's administration is over.
You had the one, what was it? He was a senator, I think, from New Jersey. He had been in Goldman Sachs, then he became a senator from New Jersey. Then he became governor of New Jersey. Then he became president of Goldman Sachs. And that was all during...
Bob Torricelli, I think.
Was it Torricelli?
Robert Torricelli.
No, no, not by... No, he was the one that... He was replaced by Frank Lautenberg. No, it's the other guy. I'll have to look it up. But he held all those positions. And when we had the big meltdown in 2008, it was discovered that Goldman Sachs had been using private funds, which were supposed to be separate, to pay off corporate debt, and then just trying to like shift money back again.
By the way,
what is
2008? Look, that is a perfect microcosm of institutional failure. The first thing,
absolutely,
the first thing that everybody at the Department of Treasury said was, especially after Lehman Brothers just, you know, or was it Bear Stearns? They just went in the tank, and they collapsed and they went bankrupt overnight. The first thing they said was, look, some of these banks, these investment banks, they're too big to fail. And so therefore we have to protect them, which is exactly what they did. So they got a bailout that pretty much guaranteed that
John Corzine.
John Corzine. Yes. They basically bailed these companies out. They socialized they made us.
That's exactly right.
Pay for their losses so that they would stay in business because, well, we can't let them go out of business. How did they get so big anyway? Well, they got so big anyway because at some point back in the 90s, we decided to repeal Glass-Steagall. and to tear down the firewall between investment banking and commercial banking. And all of the other deregulation, and what we ended up with was a ever smaller and smaller and smaller number of ever larger and larger and larger banks. If you, you know, get your first job and you get your first paycheck and you want to figure out where to go, like out here in California, you want to figure out where to go to deposit that very first paycheck. Well, you're going to go to either Bank of America, Union Bank, or Wells Fargo. That's it. Those are your choices. You know, First State Bank or Third National Bank, they don't exist anymore. Those are all...
For the large part, yeah, that's right.
Those are all gone now. Because we consolidated the banking industry, we ensured that commercial banks could do investment banking stuff so that losses on the investment banking side could tear down the commercial side. Washington Mutual no longer exists, for example, because their investments in subprime mortgages destroyed their entire commercial business. They ended up with debt that exceeded the entire value of their business.
And, oh yeah, Wachovia, United Bank. I mean, there were a lot that ended up getting leveled by that.
And by the way, we let them get away with it. We know that Standard & Poor's and Moody's were taking a look at these subprime pieces of crap and saying, well, you have just enough crap in there that it magically becomes diversified and then becomes AAA.
And not one person from the rating agency has ever been held accountable.
No, nobody ever went to jail. Nobody, look.
They weren't even tried. They weren't even investigated.
Nobody at Goldman Sachs went to jail. Nobody at Shearson Lehman, American Express went to jail. Nobody at Bear Stearns. They all just
Stearns lost their company.
Of course, Bear Stearns doesn't exist anymore. However, let's see, choice between losing my company and going to, as Office Space puts it, federal pound me in the ass prison, losing my company seems to be a pretty good alternative.
I'll take that deal.
And by the way, who's going to pay for all this? Well, the taxpayers are, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I remember you and I and Bruce talking about this at the time. There was a very simple solution that could have been put on the table. If we're going to have to spend $800 billion, let's not give it to Goldman Sachs. Let's give it to the FDIC. And if your Washington Mutual account, Washington Mutual goes tits up, don't worry about it. The FDIC will send you a check.
We've over-insured you.
We'll remove the limits, which was, I think, $10,000 on checking, $100,000 on savings. We'll remove those limits. We'll pay you the full value of whatever you had in your account, and we will make the depositors whole. What about the banks and the executives and all their employees? Well, I guess they're screwed. We will make the taxpayers whole. We'll make the account holders whole. That option was always available, and nobody even was interested in pushing it. Why is that? Why did we decide to bail out the banks? Oh, and by the way, create a moral hazard so that they know that if we do this again in the future, don't worry, we'll fix that too.
They did. Just recently, last year, what were the two banks, the two big investment banks, Silver something and
one out here in California. Yeah, sure. We'll just pay it off. The taxpayers.
And they overinsured the investors there. Yep. Even though they were capped at 250, the federal government said, no, okay, we're just going to pay you everything because these are special circumstances.
Profits, public losses. Man, if you can get that business model going, that's great for you, isn't it?
Isn't that the definition of crony capitalism?
Yeah, well, sure. Yeah, you know, I'm always amused when people talk about how, you know, America has free markets. Yeah, where?
Only in the black markets.
I mean, if you want to see what a free market economy looks like, as weird as it sounds to those who always talk about how it's some sort of socialist paradise, you want to see what a real free market economy looks like, go to Sweden and start a business. Mm-hmm. Because you can. Mm-hmm. Now, certainly, all the money you make from that business, the Swedish government will take 60% of it away from you. Granted, yep. because you have to fund that welfare state. But
your barriers to entry are very low.
Yeah.
And it's like that in all the Scandi states.
Yeah. You can get a business license. You can start a business. There's very little regulation on your business. Obviously, taxes are high in those countries, which is why they call them
very high.
But, you know, it's weird. If you talk to a Swedish politician and say Sweden is a socialist country, hell, even a Danish politician, they get very upset. No, we're not. We have a completely free market. You can start a business at the drop of a hat in Sweden or Denmark or Norway because there are so few barriers to entry and so few regulatory barriers compared to the United States. We have
they are generous welfare states. I mean, they're Bismarckian states in that sense, but they are not, they don't really control what you say or do. It's varying between the different ones, but they are very open about you starting a new business. They'll help you start a new business. They like it when you start new businesses, and they keep those startup costs very, very, very low
because they know
they're very helpful to new business
because they know that once you start making money, they can tax 60% of your income back away.
Right. And that you'll hire people. You'll actually create a wealth base. And, you know, especially, you know, places like Norway and Sweden, which have, you know, a couple of big cities, but the rest of it is pretty well spread out. There's small towns and villages. They don't have a lot of big commercial markets. They've only got a couple really each. And then they have a lot of, you know, smaller towns, industrial towns, some of them. And then farming villages and fishing villages. If you can create value in some of those small towns, create hiring opportunities, jobs, the governments are going to be right behind you, including the municipal governments, because they want you to do that. They are happy for you to do that, and they'll help you.
By the way, some updates from chat. We were talking about Silicon Valley Bank out here in California.
That was the one.
And also, I am informed it is more like 75 childhood vaccinations between postpartum and starting school.
Is that right? I mean, they combine so many of them in each shot. I mean, my youngest is 12, and so she would have gotten the last of those things around 4 or 5, I think. And I mean, they get them basically about 6 weeks after they're born, and you get they don't overload them. But there are a bunch packed into each shot. So, I mean, I have no idea how many actual immunizations it is. I do know that they don't stop.
Apparently, it's up to around 75. So we've gone from 50 years ago giving 7 immunizations, childhood immunizations that were required, to 75. And look, the 7 that were required were pretty darn important. Measles. Yeah. Because measles kill, whooping cough kills kids, diphtheria. Yeah, all of that stuff, pretty darn important. And of course, when I was a kid, there was still smallpox, which, you know, everybody.
And mumps and polio,
Polio. I forgot polio. Polio was the big one.
Some of our parents grew up knowing at least one person affected by polio. Maybe not a direct, somebody's brother or aunt or whatever. Well, like, that was a common thing. You knew somebody that had polio.
When I was 4 years old, I was living, my mom and I were living with my grandparents in their house outside of Houston in Sheldon, Texas. And my uncle, who at the time was probably, I was 4, so he'd probably be about 16, 17, and you used to be able to buy these at Montgomery Ward's, a Montgomery Ward's motorcycle. That, of course, Montgomery Ward's doesn't even exist anymore. But he had a Montgomery Ward's motorcycle. It had just rained heavily, as it is wont to do in Houston, Texas. And all the ditches were full of water and everything. And my grandparents at their house on Long Play Drive had a gravel driveway. It was these really small, tiny little pieces of pebble that was their driveway. Everything was wet. And my uncle said, hey, do you want to take a little ride? And I said, yes, I do. And so he popped me on his Montgomery Ward's motorcycle, hit the end of the driveway, tried to turn, lost the back end. The motorcycle went off onto the other side of the road, and we ended up in a ditch full of water, which I was four, so it was about chest high on me. Neither one of us were hurt or anything. I was a little shocked because it was the very first motorcycle accident I was ever involved in. Sadly, not the last. But what I remember distinctly about that is that my grandmother saw it happen outside the living room window at the front of the house. And she immediately ran out of the house. And the first words out of her mouth were, get out of that ditch before you get the polio. And of course, this is 1968. What is polio? I mean, polio had been cured back in 1956. So I didn't know anything about it. But the very idea that I might get polio was so ingrained in her because she grew up in an area, in an era when, of course, millions of kids every year ended up paralyzed from polio.
That's right. And then what FDR had?
Yes, FDR had polio as well. He got it, and he got it as an adult.
Yeah.
And by the way, never picked.
Yeah, so it was a pretty common thing, you know, for a long time.
Yeah.
So that vaccine was very welcome.
Right, but 75? Again, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying anything about the vaccines themselves. Privately, I may or may not have opinions. Who knows? But just the idea that there has been this expansion of the vaccination program at the same time when you have the possibility of regulatory capture over the CDC and the NIH and this revolving door between, you know, Bayer and pharma and GlaxoSmithKline as an executive and then back into the Department of Health. Does that have any indication? I mean, look, during COVID, the World Health Organization said remdesivir is not a appropriate therapeutic treatment for COVID. A, the side effects are too bad, and B, it doesn't appear to have any efficacy. Why did the United States government, alone in the world, decide to say, you know what, the WHO is wrong. We're going to not just allow, but it was the required treatment for COVID, remdesivir.
Right. And it had to be tried before anything else.
Yeah. Why?
Oh, gee, why?
It's difficult to come up with another reason other than because it,
cui bono.
It funnels federal money to the manufacturer of remdesivir. And by the way, the implication of that is it effective? Maybe, maybe not. Does it have bad side effects? Yeah, maybe, maybe not. Do we care? No. And that is the problem. We talk about institutional rot. Now we're making decisions about your health care without any assurance that your well-being is the primary reason behind making that decision. The remdesivir thing alone should make so many people look very askance at the entire public health system that we have built up, because I find it rather compelling prima facie evidence of regulatory capture right there on its face.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And you know, what's sort of galling about that is for years, I argued in favor of pharmaceutical companies because the attacks from the left were economically illiterate.
They're greedy and they're inflating prices.
Well, of course they're greedy. Yes, they do inflate, but that has nothing to do. If you want to actually have these products, you need to actually grease the wheels a little bit. But
yes, because the
this is way beyond the pale.
The average time it takes to bring a drug to market with all of the requirements in the United States is 14 years. So right. It takes a 14-year span of phase one, phase two.
And that's only for the successful drugs.
Yeah, that's only the successful drugs because, again, phase one, phase two, phase three clinical trials, the feds can knock you out at any point. By the way, there's any number of products that have been approved for use in Europe that can't be approved in the United States. And we know that's that right. They're safe and effective because they've been using them in Europe for 20, 25 years. But you can't get them approved in the United States. We do impose... Our free market imposes exorbitant regulatory costs on big pharma.
I like that. Our free market.
Yeah. Because, I mean, there are a lot of things that I would have thought 20 years ago and would have said them without any hint of irony or sarcasm that I find myself mentally, every time that phrase comes into my mind, putting scare quotes around it because I no longer believe it to be true. And I don't believe
that's
it to
the
be
problem.
True because
I mean, you talked about it earlier, right? I mean, you said that, you know, it's the faith in these institutions. And once that faith is gone and it seems to be rapidly receding, your institutions are nothing more than hollowed out husks. They're, you know, watchtowers with useless people up there who really don't matter to you.
And they are peopled.
And you sure as hell don't matter to them.
And they are peopled by a whole bunch of activists, just like those that we showed a few minutes ago, who are intent on pursuing whatever their agenda may be. So you have, at one level, these people who have their own agenda, and they are pursuing that to the exclusion of their legally required duties. And then, of course, you have the regulatory capture aspect. How much of the decision making is made so that the very industry they are supposed to regulate can profit?
Well, and I think, you know, when we talk about a political class that is separate from the rest of us peons, I mean, we're pretty well describing exactly who those people are. They are the bureaucracy. You know, they are the captured industries. They are the politicians. These are the people who make decisions for everybody else, whether it's in our best interests or not, as long as it's in their best interests. And that's why I look at it as we're being run by an oligarchy.
And we have this, and look, I've started to call it this non-sarcastically as well, we have this meaningless fiction of democracy. I mean, we go every 2 or every 4 years and we vote. And in general, the people for whom we vote win those elections. They get to go to Washington, D.C. Funny that if you're an incumbent, you're almost guaranteed to stay in Washington, D.C. Interesting how that works. But
yeah.
We go through all of these motions, and at the end of the day, we have created a system where Congress doesn't actually run anything. And by the way, our system is supposed to be one of congressional supremacy.
Correct.
Congress is supposed to trump everything. And Congress has decided, yeah, we're not really interested in that. I mean, look at this argument that we're having with Joe Biden right now over the budget and the decision to either, you know, fund border closures or fund Ukraine.
It's a ridiculous comparison. They are such two different animals, and it's so clear that the one that benefits us directly is the one that should take precedence. And yet somehow they're on equal ground, equal footing, even though we don't even know what the hell Ukraine is spending that damn money on or who it's going to.
No, because
we have no accountability whatsoever.
Because every time somebody like Mike Lee in the Senate, right. Thomas Massey in the House says, hey, why don't we just audit this money? Because we do know that Ukraine, like Russia, is extraordinarily corrupt. Why don't we just see where this money is going? Oh, you're some sort of Putin stooge.
You hate America.
Yeah,
you are a Putin puppet.
Look, we went through this so much to the point that I remember us texting this to each other all the time after 9/11 and all the talk about terrorism and how, you know, we can't let the terrorists win. And every time one of us said something that was slightly critical, I remember the other one of us always saying, and by the way, John was involved in this too. So John, you, Bruce, I, you know, why do you hate America and freedom?
Ah, the good old days.
And look, Ukraine has become another one of those, why do you hate America and freedom? Look.
Yeah, well, they've got to have that wedge always.
And look, nobody thinks Putin is a worse person than I do. And nobody would enjoy more seeing Russia, the idiot stepsister of Western civilization, thoroughly humiliated and depowered. I think that would be a good thing. Do I think enough of it to keep sending our entire armory of 88-millimeter mortars or 105-millimeter artillery shells to Ukraine? All of our, you know, look, we can give them all the stingers they want. We don't even make the damn things anymore. Okay, great. We don't need them. We don't need them.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah. No. I mean, I think our last bunch of Stingers was like the Block 3 Stingers. And I think we stopped buying them at the end of the 1990s, early 2000s, somewhere in there. So what we have in the inventory is all we have. And we honestly don't give a shit about Stingers because we have way better things now than Stingers. When I was in the military, I was present at some of the initial testing of the Stinger missiles at White Sands Missile Range because I was stationed at Holloman Air Force Base at that time. So I got to observe some of the initial testings of the Stingers. Okay, this is 1985. The Stinger is an old weapon system. We got way better stuff now. So look, I'll give them our entire inventory of Stingers. I don't care. But
the issue is Ukraine really the champion we want to stand up to Russia? I mean, could we have somebody better?
Yeah, I mean,
maybe a little less corrupt.
But
Poland.
On the other hand, it was Ukraine that Russia invaded. So look, I get that it's a problem, but again, is it as big a problem for us as it should be for Germany, France,
yeah,
Great Britain,
the people who
Norway,
aren't paying for it,
Sweden. How about those people? I mean, they're the ones that border the Soviet Union or border Russia. Not sure that it's really totally incumbent on us to fund it. And look, they are sending some funding and they have much smaller militaries, but that's the big issue in Congress. That's what the Democrats are pushing for. The Democrats are pushing this Ukraine thing and they will not give border funding without Republicans giving them what they want in Ukraine. How are those
because
two
they don't
things
want
linked?
Border funding.
Yeah, that's right. They don't want border funding. And
I mean, even the stupid deal that they've offered up is, and I love how they keep framing it. It's just so incredibly dishonest. We want more CBP agents to go down to the border for enforcement. Well, what are they going to do when they get there? Well, they're going to, you know, process more people. Well, that's really the opposite of what we're talking about. We don't want you to, you know, faux legalize more people coming in. We want you to stop the flow. It's really that simple. And all we keep getting from this administration is, well, look, we, you know, since day one, we had this comprehensive, immigration reform that we wanted to do, and it would make it so much easier to process these people and put them on different tracks to becoming citizens. And it's like,
yeah, we don't
idiots,
want
that's not what we're talking about.
Yeah, and that's the thing, right? This whole idea, well, we want to process these people so that they can come in and they have the ability to work and they get a pathway to citizenship. That's what we want. Is that what the average low-income worker wants? I bet it's not. I bet
it's absolutely detrimental to their own interests.
I bet the average worker would like to see some sort of increase in real income.
Yeah.
But what has middle class income looked like for the past 30 years, 40 years? Not great. You know,
we've got a big bump in the 90s and then for a while during the 2000s. Stagnated and then started growing again under Trump literally day one, January 20th.
Yeah, and by the way, it's the first thing Joe Biden did when he jumped in is he basically reopened.
He literally sat down in at the Oval Office at the Resolute desk and started signing executive orders, undoing everything that had been done before.
Completely reversed everything that Donald Trump had done on the border. And now then claims, well, I have no power. to shut down the border. You have to give me power and, you know, fund Ukraine for me because that's important to my party.
I don't know if you read that
for whatever reason.
If you read any of the actual proposed power that he wants, but it reads an awful lot like an enabling act. I mean, I've got to be honest. It puts a lot of emergency power into the hands of the executive
that he doesn't need,
and it reads an awful lot like an enabling act.
Yeah, well, institutional failure is dragging us down, and my big fear at this point is it's going to drag us into a civil war. That somebody is going to make a miscalculation. And somebody else is going to say, well, by golly, you're in an insurrection. And then we're going to be off to the races. And there
and that's what we're seeing right now at the border with this whole thing with Texas. Yeah, and the arguments going on from the left that the president should nationalize the Texas National Guard, which, I mean, I know it's within his power to do so, but I don't believe we are actually in any of the circumstances. He would have to declare an emergency, which he could do. We have an emergency at the border.
Yeah,
that's going to be a step too far. I think that would be probably the last piece of the puzzle to ignite something violent.
I know
in a civil war fashion.
This is the thing that terrifies me, and so many people are just so blasé about it. There is a whole thread, super popular currently on Twitter, which is to post a picture of your Civil War II ride. And so, you know, people are posting pictures of Jeeps or people riding dragons or whatever it may be. It's all a big laugh to them. No, 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 no. There's no possible way.
Try a covered wagon, assholes.
There's no,
that's what you're going to be left with.
There is no possible way that if some sort of civil war were to start up now, that it would not result in the millions, in the deaths of tens of millions of people in fairly short order.
Yes.
We have a system that's designed to run like clockwork as long as the roads and the rails and the airports and everything else are open. Once that closes down, you have 3 days of food in cities and then you have nothing. So if you live in any urban area, starvation starts on day 5.
Yeah, try getting fuel.
Yeah, I mean, there's no way that we can maintain the infrastructure that feeds and clothes and heats or cools us every day if this thing goes off the rails. People don't realize, and you know, so many people say, well, you know, they hold up these state maps, right? And say, well, if these states do this, they're in a really bad position. What makes you think this isn't 1861. This is not going to break down among state lines.
Right.
You'd be far better off looking at a county map of the 2022 election to see what the actual opposing forces look like. And what you've got is this big red area where all of the food and energy is produced and these isolated blue areas where it's all consumed. Yeah. Half the population, slightly more than live there. Yeah, sure. Where are they going to go? It's just going to be a disaster. Everything is going to fall apart. Now, people who live in the big, empty red areas will probably be okay over the long term because, after all, that's where the food and energy is produced. They at least have access to their own means for producing food, which you don't have in the cities. But beyond that...
And what does the federal government give them anyway?
Yeah, and by the way, beyond that, what about how does the international scene look if the United States gets embroiled in even a minor civil conflict where all of our attention is turned inward? We might as well just give China a free pass to invade Taiwan. Russia.
Taiwan's gone. Israel's immediately at full-scale war, probably nuclear war. Turkey, Russia, that whole area is going to be a complete mess. Europe is going to be a complete mess.
Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia.
Yeah, the Baltic states are, in Finland, and they're under full court press. It would be really bad. Who knows what North Korea would do? There's already signs that they're possibly contemplating some sort of military action against South Korea to unite the Koreas. It would fall. Everything would fall apart very quickly if the United States is involved in some sort of serious civil war.
And as far as I can tell, we're
just blithely walking into it.
Yeah, I guess the thing that bothers me is that you know, we've been talking about this for 20 years at this point. Yeah. And it's always seemed like this inevitability that will happen at some point in the future.
Well, indeed, it's the kangaroo, right?
Indeed, probably sometime after we've both passed away. There'll be some point where these tensions will flare up. And look, at this point, the best we can hope for is some sort of national divorce.
Right. We've been talking about that for at least 10 years.
Yeah. But if we're having this immigration thing where we're now actually calling out the National Guard, I'm getting uncomfortably, you know, this whole Civil War thing that was this, you know, bad thing, but that would be at some distant point in the future, now looks like it's getting closer and closer. And I'm seeing people, you know, on social media who are saying, fine, bring it on. We'll destroy those yahoos in flyover countries, and, you know, people posting pictures of B-2 bombers dropping bombs. So, you know, one squadron of A-10 at a Selfridge Air Force Base and wipe you people out. That's not how it's going to go down. Don't be so blithe about this. You know, maybe I can't shoot down a B-2, but you know who I can shoot? All of the people who refuel, rearm, and pilot it.
That's right. If they're even going to consider carrying out those orders.
Yeah. Yeah. If that.
I think we'd see a lot of mutiny in the military.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it would. I mean, it would go south so quickly and so irretrievably disastrously that I don't know what kind of America would come out of it at the end of it.
I don't think America would come out.
Yeah, neither do I. And people are so blithe about it. And they either dismiss the possibility that it could happen, or they just assume, oh, yeah. Well, and look, by the way, it happens on the right, too. Yeah, enjoy no food and no gas.
Yeah, there's this sort of assumption that core heads will prevail. We've always, you know, weathered these storms, and we need the government to do this and to do that. And, you know, we're set up. All we got to do is just, you know, let it keep moving along. And no, I mean, that's historically, that's just nonsense. It's never, ever happened.
But see, here's the problem. Post the Civil War, so basically since 1865, we decided we were going to reunite as a nation. And certainly for all of the 20th century, there was a general agreement about what the government was supposed to do. Sure, we could have talks about taxes and social programs and whatnot. But in terms of what America was and what the general limits on government power and competence was, there was large agreement. And if the Democrats won, you know, if Eisenhower won in 1952, it wasn't that big a deal, because in 1960, Jack Kennedy will win. And things will sort of veer, you know, sort of left or right of the center.
Right. But they're all kind of contained within this sort of channel.
Yeah, we have this channel that we know we are going to travel down. And if the other party wins, hey, you know, congratulations. We'll come back and get you next time.
Right.
But whenever you look like this whole thing about that Millie Weaver showed with these government employees, we no longer want to be governed by the other side. This is not a case of, I just got to take my lumps and we'll come back and win it. It is, if they win, it's a disaster.
It's the end of the world.
And we have to do, and by the way, if they win, and we've already gotten this with Trump, if they win, it's illegitimate. Mm-hmm. It was illegitimate whenever Trump won because of Russia collusion. It was illegitimate when Biden won for the other side because 2020 stolen election, which, by the way, every losing side since 2000 has claimed stolen election. Hillary Clinton claimed it in 2016.
Well, except 2008.
except 2008. That was pretty much a gimme. We all knew that we were going to elect the black guy because that meant we weren't racist anymore, or so we naively thought. If you can't even agree to be governed by the other side because you were so far apart ideologically, what's the reason for any sort of national unity? What is it that you have in common that makes you want to live in the same country as your ideological opponents?
Well, and that's just that I think you hit the nail on the head there, because look, it's the same thing that befell the Roman Empire.
We don't have to go with that.
In terms
we don't have to go back that far. We can just go to Yugoslavia.
Okay. Well, Yugoslavia, though, was hobbled together after World War I. The Roman Empire, its dying days were because nobody believed in Rome anymore. It was a lost illusion. And the people who were supposed to be taking care of it and celebrating and showing off the glory of Rome, exhibiting the glory of Rome, lost interest. They didn't believe in it anymore.
All they cared about was getting their free bread.
And we kind of see a similar thing here in America. We don't even teach American history anymore. We barely teach Western culture. People have no idea how we got to where we are now. Well, they have no clue.
We do teach Americans history in the sense that the country was founded by a whole bunch of racists who created it on the backs of dead Indians and black slaves.
Yep.
But yeah, that's the extent of it. However, we are we're over an hour and 40 minutes. So you know what we should probably do? We should probably pick this up again next week. So, Michael.
All right. Same time, same bat channel.
Have a great week. We'll talk to you next week.
Bye.
You have been listening to, or watching, in fact, the Observations Podcast for Sunday, the 29th of January, 2024. We appreciate the fact that you are watching, and we hope that you'll watch again next time. Until then, have a great week. So long.